I noticed that the current federal government is planning to give us GST holidays starting in mid-December, actually, on many purchases. And this plan is going to go into effect for a couple of months, so December, January, February. And it's going to cost the Treasury $1.68 billion. There's also a plan being worked on to give all Canadians a $250 tax rebate in the new year for working people. And the total cost of Treasury of this $250 tax rebate is going to cost $4.68 billion. So the total cost of these two programs is, I've got it there, $6.36 billion. Now, I can appreciate that for many Canadians, both the GST holiday and the bonus payment of $250 could be a lifeline to them. But I'm a bit uneasy about the approach that's being taken because all this money is being borrowed. It's borrowed money. So basically, we're taking money from the future, from our grandchildren and great-grandchildren, and we're giving it to ourselves today as a tax holiday, as a tax rebate. I don't know about you, but that doesn't quite sit right with me. In fact, it seems to me there's something wrong about it in some basic way. I feel actually distressed by it in some form. I mean, if the government had a large surplus sitting in the bank account and we had to decide as a country whether to pay down debt or to invest it in housing or defense or in healthcare or in the environment, and it was decided instead to take that surplus and use it as in tax and give people tax rebates, then I think we could have a reasonable debate about that, for sure. And the decision, if we decided to give it back to people in rebates, wouldn't distress me at all. There's just something about having a free lunch that doesn't work for me, personally. Instead of making hard decisions and deciding priorities, we take the expedient way out and we charge the whole exercise to the future. John Maynard Keynes, I've got a picture up there, was the first economist to come up with the idea of deficit financing. Deficit financing is borrowing from the future to pay for the present. Before Keynes, the free market had these wild ups and downs, years of exponential growth followed by times of deep contraction. We call those times of deep contraction recessions and depressions. And his proposal was that during bad economic times, governments run deficits and use this extra money to drive higher demand in the economy. And during the good times of growth, governments would run surpluses and pay down the debt that they run up in the bad times. That's what his model was. That's what his proposal was. And it's a pretty clever idea when you think about it. And it makes a lot of sense. The highs and lows in the economy are tempered in order to create some stability in people's lives because the boom-bust cycles of the past were hugely destructive to people's real-life circumstances. And we only have to go back to the Great Depression to see the impact of these boom-bust cycles. In the downtimes, people went through incredible sufferings. They lost everything in many cases. Through no fault of their own, they lost so much. And they had often their practical lives destroyed by the collapse of the economy. And Keynes' approach was to temper these cycles and make the future more predictable and trustworthy. There's only one problem with Keynes' theory, for all its innovation and brilliance. He didn't take into account human nature. See, because once the taboo is broken about borrowing from the future, who has no say in what we do, we borrow from the future to enhance the present, then there's really no limit how far people are prepared to go to get something today at the expense of tomorrow. And what's happened over the past 75 years is that governments have run deficits in bad times and built up a huge amount of debt, which according to Keynes is a good thing. Running debt in bad times is a good thing. That's how the model's supposed to work. But in the good times, governments never run the surpluses that were needed to pay down the debt that was accumulated in the bad time. And in practice, during good times, governments ran balanced budgets or they ran small deficits. And during bad times, governments ran large deficits. And the consequence is that the public debt kept growing over these years. The national debt in Canada today stands at $1.45 trillion. $1.45 trillion. And that doesn't include the accumulated debt of the provinces. Ontario's provincial debt sits at $431 billion. And if you add up all the provincial debt, it's probably $2.5 trillion. That's how much Canada is in debt at the government, at the public level. And the reason why our debt keeps growing is quite simple. There's no political payoff for running surpluses and paying off all that public debt. When the money is flowing in the economy, things are going really well, and the government coffers are full, people want expanded government programs. The idea that the government would take surplus money and pay off the debt that had been accumulated in the bad times, instead of investing in health, expanded health care, or housing, or defense, or education, or in old age pension supplements, it's just not in the cards. And that's where Keynes' idea breaks down. See, in Canada, since 1950, the federal government has only run large surpluses in 4 years of those 75 years. It was during the late 90s and early 2000s when John Chrétien's government ran large surpluses, and they paid off a large amount of the national debt. That's it, over 75 years, 4 years where the public debt was reduced in a substantial way. And I want to be clear, this is not an ideological argument. Both sides of the political aisle, both sides of the political spectrum have contributed to the accumulation of debt in Canada. One of the most hard-nosed politicians against going into debt was Tommy Douglas. He was the first CCF premier in the country back in the 1940s in Saskatchewan. And he became later the leader of the federal NDP. He was fairly left-wing in his politics, but Douglas was adamant that he didn't want bankers dictating government policy, which meant he didn't want his province, Saskatchewan, or he didn't want the country, Canada, to be highly indebted to bankers. And I want to stress, this is not a uniquely Canadian problem. Many countries around the world are hugely indebted. The U.S. has a national debt of $35 trillion. $35 trillion. Now, I personally don't think we should put all our blame on governments or on political parties. They're doing exactly what we want them to do. They're borrowing from the future to pay for the present, because we demand that our present needs take precedence over our future responsibilities. In a democratic society like Canada, governments represent their people. Ultimately, the people get what they want. And what we want is to make today easier for ourselves, even if we compromise the future in doing so. And I find this whole situation somewhat depressing, to be honest. I don't see things changing anytime soon. I don't see how I see an easy ramp for us to get off this cycle that we're now in. Now that we've unleashed the appetite for transferring the blessings of the future into the present, what is the limiting principle for us? What is the limiting principle for us for not tapping more and more into our future to pay for the present? Is there any limiting principle today, really? Today is the first Sunday of Advent. The theme is hope. And isn't hope, in its simplest form, the belief that things can change for the better? That there's a reason to think and to believe that whatever is happening today, whatever it might be, however difficult it might be for us, however overwhelming it might feel to us, that it can be different tomorrow or the next day than it is today. That's hope in its simplest form. And the question really is, on what basis do we believe that tomorrow is going to be better than today? Or is there any basis to believe that tomorrow is going to be better than today? Because if there's no basis to think or believe that change for the better is possible for us, then we are quite rational to be somewhat depressed by this. To be depressed by whatever it is that's getting us down in life. As far as I can see, the problem we face today principally resides within ourselves and in our human nature. Whatever we're dealing with, whatever problem it might be, ultimately commanding our attention. It always seems ultimately to come back to us and to our flawed nature, our selfish, self-centered, self-seeking ways, which really in its form is our desire to sit on our own thrones. That means we might be somewhat misguided to think that the solution to any problem we have today, is going to be primarily found in us. Certainly, if we are committed to sitting on our own thrones, even though the temptation is always going to be to sit on our own thrones, even though the temptation is always going to come back to looking at our human structures to resolve our problems, to fix whatever it is that's getting us down, is it wise to keep looking to ourselves for the solution? The situation for Israel in Isaiah 40 that was read today by Paul was pretty bleak, actually. I don't know if you know the backstory to this. In some ways, it's much bleaker than what we're facing today in this world. Israel got caught up in the politics of the Middle East, and they tried to play the human game of power politics, and they got burned for it. They picked the wrong side, and they lost everything. The consequence of their foolhardiness was that the enemy sacked their beloved Jerusalem. The enemy destroyed the temple of God. The enemy laid waste to the countryside and then deported a large portion of the people to a faraway land. Things had become so bleak that the people had naturally devolved into a state of depression. Israel had become a hopeless people. Israel had no confidence that things could change for the better for themselves. They had no reason to believe that the future would be any different than the present that they were currently living. And perhaps worst of all for them, they had to live with the reality that they had brought this blight upon themselves. They had sat on the throne of their own circumstances. They had claimed the right to themselves. They had asserted management over their own lives and had absolutely and completely betrayed them, brought them to ruin. And now they were completely powerless. They had been knocked down in the previous war. They had lost everything. They had no agency in the world anymore. They were completely dependent on the mercy of a people who had placed them in their current circumstances. That was not a good place to be. It's actually a terrible place to be. And part of their hopelessness was that they kept turning to themselves for the solution. And because they couldn't see any way forward in themselves, because they had no power or agency in life, they couldn't see how things could change for them. And they gave up hope. I don't think that's hard for us to imagine. It's not hard for us to imagine how they felt. Isn't it often that we find ourselves in those places in our own lives? Whatever it is we're dealing with, we can't figure out how to make things change for us. We often don't feel we have any agency in the situations we're struggling with or dealing with. We don't have any power to deal with our circumstances. We feel powerless before whatever it is that dominates us. And to cap it off, if we're honest to ourselves, we often find ourselves up against something that we helped create. We decided to sit on our own throne. We chose to live life as we wanted. We asserted our claim to a right to ourselves. We put our life under our own management. We moved forward without God's counsel. And then we find ourselves faced with an undesirable reality that we created. And that's hard to come to terms with. And in the midst of it all, we sometimes wonder, where's God? Where's God? Having fired God from our lives, we wonder at times whether we've moved beyond the forgiveness and mercy of God. We booted God out, and we are now suffering the natural consequences for our decision, but we still wonder where God is in all this. Perhaps God has abandoned us to our choices. Perhaps God has abandoned us to the natural consequences that arise from us firing him from our lives. See, the one calculation that Israel was not considering in determining their possible future was God. They looked to themselves. They looked at what was lined up against them, and they became depressed and hopeless because they didn't see a way out of it. They didn't see a way for things to change for the better because they were not taking into consideration the movement of God in their circumstances. God was not part of their calculation. Israel thought they had gone beyond God's grace and goodness. They'd blown it up so completely that God had obviously given up on them. That's why today's passage, Isaiah says, "Why, O Jacob, do you say and declare, O Israel, my way is hidden from God, from the Lord, my cause is disregarded by God?" Isaiah was obviously dealing with people who felt that they had gone beyond the grace and goodness of God. Do you ever feel that way in your own circumstances? Do you feel that you've, in what you're dealing with, that you've gone beyond God's grace and goodness? Israel felt that they'd fallen out of favor with God. Or perhaps they had simply become blind and indifferent to God's grace and goodness for them, so they didn't take it into account. Do you ever do that? Not take God's grace and goodness for you into account in your decision making? When you're trying to figure something out in your life, when you're assessing what you're up against and what the solution might be, do you forget to take God into consideration in all your calculations? Isaiah had a big task facing him. He's dealing with a depressed people who see no way out, who have given up, and for whatever reason, they have given up on God's grace and goodness for their circumstances. And he says to him, "Do you not know? Have you not heard? Have you forgotten? In your depression and hopelessness, have you failed in all your calculations to remember the reality of God?" Isaiah has to remind them who God is. He is the Lord. He is the everlasting God, the creator of all things. Isaiah has to remind them of God's nature, of God's character. God is indomitable, doesn't get tired or weary the way human beings do. God is not tired of our self-centered ways and the way we get tired with each other. God gives us strength. God gives strength to the weary. God gives the power to the weak. God even helps out those who are enduring the natural consequences of firing him. God is still active and involved in people's lives today. Isaiah says human strength can fail, but God's strength won't. Even youths grow tired and weary, young men stumble and fall, but those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. See, there are limits to human endurance. Every human relationship has a breaking point in it. But we are not to make that into an analogy for our relationship with God or God's relationship with us. Human beings have breaking points, but God does not have a breaking point in his relationship with us. God is not like us. God is not limited in human ways the way we are. So Isaiah says to Israel, never take your current circumstances in any way as a sign about God's ultimate loyalty to you. There's nothing in this reality that can break God's love for you. Question is, do we believe that? Because that's why we hear the message today read in church. Do we believe that? God's love is unbreakable. That's part of the blessing of following Jesus. Jesus reveals this truth to us, the unbreakable nature of God's love for us. Paul says in Romans chapter 8, he says that if God is for us, then who can be against us? Who has ultimate power over the saints of God? And the answer, of course, is no one. And nothing has power ultimately over the saints of God. But the question then becomes, well, how do we know this is true? And Paul says in Romans 8:32, and I've got it in the slide, Dave, he says this, "He who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, how will he not also along with him graciously give us all things?" See, that's the basis of our hope as followers of Jesus. Our hope doesn't reside in us. Our hope rests in the grace and goodness of God. Our hope doesn't reside in our own righteousness or our own wisdom. It rests in the mercy and love of our Heavenly Father for us. Our hope doesn't lie in what we can do, but it relies on what God can do through us. Paul ends Romans chapter 8 with these famous words. He says this, and I've got some slides, Dave. "No, in all these things we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. For I'm convinced that neither death nor life, neither angels nor demons, neither the present nor the future, nor any powers, neither height nor depth, nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God that is in Christ Jesus our Lord. That means nothing can separate us from anything and everything that God has for us. And it's when this truth is lived out in the lives of real people that the vision of Isaiah starts to take shape. People will soar on wings like eagles. Why? Because they have turned to God. They've turned to God's grace and goodness, and that becomes their hope. That's how they could soar like an eagle. People will run and not grow weary because they now have the freedom and the power of God's companionship in their life. And they will walk in their circumstances and not be faint, not be afraid, because they know that it is God, they know that God is with them in it all. And if God is with them, there is nothing that can get in the way, nothing that can stand against them. And when I remember all this, and I often forget it, then I don't feel so depressed about Canada's finances or the circumstances of the world today. In fact, I see this is an opportunity for Trillium, because I realize the remedy is right in front of us. People only take for today what belongs to tomorrow when they have no hope for the future. Our task is to bring more and more people into a living relationship with Jesus Christ, who is our hope and our future. It's no coincidence to me, at least, that our taking from the future for today comes about exactly at the same time as there's this growing faithlessness and hopelessness in our society. So many people today have no hope or faith in the future. They have no confidence in the future. And left to ourselves, we can see why that would be the case. We all know what happens in life when we put ourselves in charge of our circumstances. In fact, in a certain kind of way, it's a completely rational response. If we're only centering on ourselves, if we're only trusting ourselves, if we're only relying on ourselves, it's completely rational why we might become depressed because of this. Why not take the blessing of tomorrow for today and run with it if that's the case? Only people who have a confidence in the future can resist the temptation to take for today what truth belongs to tomorrow. We don't need to take from tomorrow if we trust in today, because God is with us in it. But remember, we can only trust in tomorrow because God is fully in our calculations. And at Trillium, we are a people of hope. We believe in tomorrow because we believe in God. We believe God is with us. We believe in tomorrow because we trust that the presence and the power of God is with us in our life circumstances today. And if we let God sit upon our throne, that sit upon the throne of our circumstances, if we step down and we make space for God, if we make room for God, God will step up and show us a future. God will step up and show us a future, and that future will extend beyond anything and everything we could ever imagine.